Looks like Bruh Fox and Bruh Bear are causing some kind of commotion downstream. Please stay in your boats while we take care of things. Your visit to Splash Mountain will continue in just a bit.
Everybody's got a laughing place to go, go, go. Take your frown, turn it upside down, and you'll find the screen.
So Br'er Rabbit's looking for a little adventure, eh? Well, now, Br'er Rabbit, maybe I'll just have to roast
ya. Yes, sir, Br'er Fox. You go right ahead and roast me. But whatever you do, please don't fling me in that dry patch. You fellas could use a good laugh. Let's go down to my laughing place.
WDW
Radio.
Your information station.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the WDW Radio Show, your Walt Disney World information station. I am your host, Lou Mangiello, and this is show number 305 for the week of December 16th, 2012. I'm here to help you have the best possible Disney vacation experience and bring you a little bit of Disney magic to wherever you are with this podcast, videos, blog, live broadcasts, special events, my Walt Disney World trivia books, audio tours, and more. And you can find everything over at wdwradio.com. So this week, we're going to connect the dots a little bit and talk about one of Walt Disney World's most popular attractions, the story that serves as the inspiration for it, and a look at its history, significance, and controversy. Jim Corcus joins me as we discuss Disney's 1946 animated and live-action film Song of the South and its connection to Splash Mountain. We'll talk about the attraction and the film, including its connection to Walt, the production, the debate, the future, and Jim's new book, Who's Afraid of Song of the South? It's a fascinating look at the film that many people haven't seen, yet features characters and songs that delight people in the Disney parks so many years after its initial release. I'll then have the answer to our last Walt Disney World trivia question of the week and pose a new challenge for your chance to win a Disney prize package. I'll then have some announcements at the end of the show, including information about the new free WDW Radio app for iPhone, iPad, Androids, and Windows mobile devices. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of the WDW Radio Show.
It happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days. Now that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song, jump right out of it. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. My, oh my, what a wonderful day.
So many of Walt Disney World's incredible attractions are based not just on wonderful stories, but tales that we're familiar with from Disney animated and live-action movies, from Dumbo to Peter Pan to Beauty and the Beast and countless others. They've inspired the attractions that let us be an active participant in experiencing. And some of the stories, though, may be a little bit less familiar to some people, although the attraction remains one of the most popular in all the Disney parks. And one such attraction that I'm referring to is Splash Mountain in Frontierland. Based on characters from Disney's 1946 film Song of the South, because the film has never been released in the U.S., many people don't know about the direct connection to the characters and the story from that film. So today, we're going to connect Song of the South to Splash Mountain and another location here in Walt Disney World, and I'm joined today by Jim Corcus, who just happens to have a new book out called Who's Afraid of Song of the South, which has just been released. Jim, good to see you again.
Always a joy to see you, Lou. It's been too long, but I know you live a hectic lifestyle, Disney cruises and media events and all of that. I'm still surprised you can do a podcast each and every week.
Well, it's a tough job, but somebody has to listen. It's a lot better than being a lawyer. What can I tell
you? Just about anything is, Lou. But this is great, and of course we're not at Splash Mountain today. We're at Port Orleans French Quarter, and we've just been having a wonderful time here, we even just discovered that Louis Armstrong sings in the men's bathroom.
Which is where we were going to record the show from, but again, it would have been a little bit more awkward than it is.
Well, I think for a lot of Disney fans and people who visit Walt Disney World, they really don't fully appreciate that the Disney resorts, they're really not hotels. They really are resorts. They're like mini theme parks with the wonderful theming and all those little elements. And so I'm glad we can talk about the book today, Who's Afraid of the Song of the South, which, again, took place in the South. And of course, the tale's also being told in New Orleans. In fact, in the outside square where we are right now, in the mid-90s, they used to have meet and greets with costumed Brer Bear and Brer Fox, especially over the holiday season. They used to do a big holiday event over here.
Yeah, you were saying, and that's really neat. You know, we've talked about some of those different kinds of character experiences, even things that you can find over at the Empress Lily Riverboat and Fort Wilderness and things like that. And I never realized that they had really a nice sort of Christmas outdoor event here as well.
Yes, and the only reason I know that is because my brother Mike, who was a Streetmosphere character at Disney MGM Studios in those days. He was the Rawhide Kid, a cowboy with a huge lasso, and people could step into the lasso and all of that. In the Christmas evenings, he'd be over here at Port Orleans dressed up as the jester, you know, in the yellow and green and purple, and would be performing out here in the courtyard at night. And Disney would give you free hot roasted chestnuts or a sugar cookie. And they had apple cider, and they had hot chocolate with marshmallows. That was all free. And then he would lead people down to the little area, which is now a playground, right in front of the pool. And he would tell the story, the French story of the first Noel, the story about the little child who put a candle in the window, you know, to guide her father back home and all of that. It was all very touching and all very wonderful. But again, as I said, the resort right now is pretty wonderful as it is.
Yeah. And look, we've talked in the past about some of the stories about resorts like Wilderness Lodge. We've done a show about, you know, Port Orleans and the very, very elaborate backstory that exists here as well, too. But, you know, in terms of some of the things like the characters, I always find it fun to introduce or maybe reintroduce or help adults remember or introduce kids to some of the great films and through the characters that you can find throughout Walt Disney World. I think about Willie the Giant and Sir Mickey's, Pecos Bill, Humphrey the Bear. Now you can really see him over in Storybook Circus. But you're unfortunately not able to do that now with some of the great characters like a Brer Fox and a Brer Bear in Splash Mountain because the film is not accessible.
Absolutely. And you know, you're talking about Brer. One of the reasons we're here at New Orleans Square as well, too, is this was partly Cajun country. And so they would use a version of French. And so in French, the French word for brother was frère. The English word was brother, of course. And so you combine them together. That's where you get Brer. And so the whole point of that, too, was that all the animals were brothers to each other. So you'd be Brer Mongello, and I'd be Brer Corcus as we went here. And these were stories that were told to children for, you know, 100 years or more. Walt Disney remembered as a child growing up hearing those stories. It was one of the things that inspired him to want to do a film or a series of films that would introduce those characters to a new generation.
So I want to, before we talk about the film itself, I do want to talk about its connection to Splash Mountain. And maybe the best way to start is by going back into history. I think we've all sort of heard the legend or the tale of Tony Baxter on his way over to Imagineering in 1983, realizing that, you know, because Walt Disney had bought the rights to these characters from the Harris family in the late 1930s, they had this wonderful story and these incredible characters and music to work off of. So he had this concept for this log flume attraction, this Zippity River Run, presents it to Michael Eisner, who says, great idea, love it, except we've got this new movie coming out, and we really want to sort of promote what this is. Tony says, well, wait, it doesn't really fit. We're talking about characters that exist in the Deep South. You're talking about characters that exist up in Massachusetts. And, of course, that film was Splash with Daryl Hannah and Tom Hanks. They come to a mutual agreement, say, all right, look, what if we did this? What if we put the name of your film in the title of the attraction? We get a new mountain. You get the name of your film. Everybody goes home unhappy. And I had a chance to meet Tony Baxter. Mm-hmm. And after getting to chat with him for a little while, I finally got up enough courage. I said, look, I've heard the story 100 times, and it just doesn't sound like it really. And I said, is that really how it happened? He says, absolutely. We had to agree on the name of Splash Mountain to, you know, appease what Michael Eisner wanted to do with the film Splash.
And in fact, the story is even richer than that. Basically, Tony wasn't just on the Santa Ana Freeway. He was stuck in traffic where it was like a parking lot. And the problem they had is America Sings, that was in the old Carousel of Progress theater, was closing. And you had all of those audio animatronic characters. You had over 100 audio animatronic characters. And so what are you going to do? Put them in storage? Or are you going to cannibalize them for something else? And the design of those characters in the attraction, of course, most people know, was done by Disney legend Mark Davis. Mark Davis was also one of the directing animators on Song of the South. And so the character designs were very, very similar. Tony also knew that Dick Nunes, who was in charge of the parks, really wanted a flume ride because Knott's Berry Farm had come out with one that was very, very popular, and Nunes felt that the Disney Imagineers could come up with something better. And to make matters worse, Bear Country was around that little curve there, and nobody was going out there. You know, all that was out there was the Country Bear Jamboree, and there was a bear restaurant pretty much, and that was it. And so it needed to draw people over to that side. And so they started to put all of these things together. Well, we could do a flume ride, and what if we use all of these characters from America Sings? This will cut the cost. All we have to do is come up with new audio animatronic figures for Br'er Rabbit and Br'er Fox and Br'er Bear, and we can do this. And so, you know, they put together the model, and it was Eisner's insistence that Uncle Remus not be in the ride anywhere. And so the narrator is Br'er Frog, who, of course, in the film is a good friend of Uncle Remus. Uncle Remus lights his pipe in a wonderful combination of live action and animation there. And yes, Eisner was just in love with the idea of Splash. The first film made out here on Orlando property was Splash 2, and you know, in Pleasure Island there was going to be Splash references there. The bottom line is, though, is that, you know, as they were trying to, they still kept trying to push, you know, the Song of the South flume, or as you alluded to, the Zippity Doodah, and all of this. And the bottom line, and Tony told me this, he says the bottom line is Eisner looked at us and he said, it's a mountain. There's a splash at the end. It's Splash Mountain.
Well, he got his log flume. We got his log flume. Right. And look, and again, he did get what he wanted, which was a film that extracts 15 or so scenes directly from that film. For those of us who have seen Song of the South, yes, Uncle Remus is noticeably absent because he is such a prominent character in the film. But for those who haven't, what they understand is they have an attraction that fits into Bear Country or Frontierland with the singing and dancing, you know, rabbits and bears and foxes.
Right. And again, they designed the ride very cleverly where people can see that final splash so that they know ahead of time whether they want to go on that ride or not. I consider Splash Mountain one of the first Disney schizophrenic rides after Walt's death. And what I mean by schizophrenic is that on Splash Mountain, I will tell you that, most of you know that I have nieces and nephews, and that I did have older parents who passed away a few years ago. And they would have loved the first part of the ride and floating around on the water and seeing these audio animatronics. But by golly, that final splash, 50 feet down, 40 miles an hour, that would have killed them. On the other hand, I do have a teenaged nephew, and he loved the splash, but he was getting diabetic fits through the first part of the ride there. And again, there's some interesting changes in the ride because, of course, one of the most famous Uncle Remus tales was the tale of the tar baby, and that is in the film. However, that has become considered racist, and in fact, in the late 40s and all, tar baby was actually a prerogative term used for black people. And so by the time of the 70s, in Disney storybooks, you'll notice that Br'er Rabbit doesn't get caught in black tar. He gets caught in white glue. It's a white glue baby. And then you notice in the Splash Mountain ride, they avoid that entirely, and he's caught in honey. So there are some nice references, but, you know, as you mentioned before, the last theatrical United States re-release of Song of the South was in 1986, so a lot of people haven't seen the film. They have no idea that those characters in there and all relate to anything, let alone a Disney film.
And when it was released, it was re-released a number of times. Well, when it was re-released for the 40th anniversary, it was released as Walt Disney's classic. That's what the poster said. And I think that's what people need to understand, too, is that this is actually a film, and by correlation, the attraction has a connection to Walt Disney, because he had said that there was something very appealing, something very satisfying about the tales of animals that behave like humans and the character who narrates them. And he said he was familiar personally with the Uncle Remus stories that sort of went beyond this since he was a kid. And he said, from the time I began making animated features, I've had them definitely in my production plans. But until now, the medium wasn't ready to give them an adequate film equivalent in scope and fidelity. And in their timeless living appeal, their magnificent pictorial quality, their rich and tolerant humor, their homely philosophy and cheerfulness, which made the Remus legends the top choice for our first production with flesh and blood players.
Okay, and I'm telling you right now, fire Tom Hanks from Saving Mr. Banks. You heard Lou Mangiello do his impression of Walt Disney. He's got to grow the mustache. Got to grow the mustache. But other than that, he's in like Flynn. No, you're absolutely true. But there were some other reasons behind the making of Song of the South. First off, in the war, Walt saw that he really needed to diversify into live action because with animation, it's so labor intensive. It takes so long. You have so many people involved. But what happened is RKO was distributing the Disney films, and so the stipulation in the contract was that Walt would produce animated films, although there was sort of a little codicil in there that you could combine live action and animation. And so that's where you get in the Three Caballeros and Saludos Amigos. And so Walt was looking at Song of the South to expand. He always considered Song of the South his first live action film. And he was looking to expand into live action, but he had to have animation in there. And the animation in Song of the South only covers a third of the film, to meet the requirements of the RKO contract. So he was looking to diversify, looking to get into live action. This was perfect. And, you know, I always say this too, Walt never liked to repeat himself, never wanted to do sequels. There's paperwork in the archives that shows that Walt was hoping Song of the South was going to be a huge success, and he would use that as a template for at least two sequels, using the same actor, Jimmy Basquiat, as Uncle Remus, in live action and then doing more animated segments, and that would be, as they say in Disney terminology today, cost effective.
Right, because there are obviously many stories, you know, that they could have
selected,
you know, drawn from in making of the film. And I think, like you said, it's classic because you did have some of those legendary Disney artists and animators, Claude Coates. I'm doing my Walt Disney. Walt had a tough time with that name, too. Mary Blair, Milt Kahl, Eric Larson, Ollie Johnson, Les Clark, Mark Davis, and John Lounsbery. So there was a lot to it in terms of artistic. Certainly the music, it had won 2 Academy Awards for Zippity Doodah's Best Song, and it was nominated for Best Scoring of Emotional Picture. And James Basquiat actually won an honorary Oscar as well.
Which was highly, highly unusual. And in fact, believe it or not, the Hollywood community was strongly behind that. It was Walt himself who wrote to the president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and said that James Basquiat should be considered. Now, again, because of the time period and all, you can't nominate James Basquiat, you know, in a regular category. That was not, you know, acceptable. And in fact, the very first black actor to win a competitive Oscar for Best Actor was Sidney Poitier in 67 for Lilies of the Field. But he felt that Basquiat really needed to be honored because the director that he had, just the live action director, just was like, okay, well, start shooting. You know, there was no, and it, so in the letter he wrote, he said Basquiat created the character himself, created a lot of those moments himself. And as I said, a lot of Hollywood was behind that. Bette Davis, Hedda Hopper, they all wrote letters in support of that. And so Ingrid Bergman gave him an Oscar, and then sadly, because of diabetes and other health problems, Basquiat passed away about 6 months later after receiving that Oscar, which was a huge loss. You know, you mentioned that 6 of the 9 old men worked directly on this film, and most of them said that it was the happiest experience of their life working on animation because they could just really break loose. Walt was always constantly trying to go towards more realism in animation, like Bambi and that. In this, they could go wild. And because there was just a short section of animation, they could devote all of their attention to that animation rather than spreading it out over 90 minutes. And by golly, and in fact, the reviewers of the film originally all had high praise for the animation. They said, we wish there had been more animation and less live action.
And so maybe what we should do, Jim, is because I think so many people have not certainly seen the film and may actually be unfamiliar with the story, let's just sort of summarize the story a little bit, and then let's talk about what this film's significance was, because I think there were a lot of important things beyond the sort of mix of live and animation that it represents.
Okay. And Brer Rabbit, Brer Fox, and Brer Bear were on their way to a meet and greet with Lou Mangiello. And along the way... No, okay.
That's the worst Walt Disney impression I've ever heard.
Basically, there's the live-action storyline, and the animation are stories that... Uncle Remus tells to a young boy to help him learn life lessons. So the bottom line is this takes place after the Civil War. Now, the film doesn't make that as clear as it should be, although there are certain references in there where you can spot it immediately, because at one point in the film, Uncle Remus says, you know, I'm packing up and I'm going. I don't have to put up with this. If this was during the time of slavery, he would be considered property. He wouldn't have the freedom to go do that. So the storyline is, and none of this was written by Joel Chandler Harris, who wrote the Uncle Remus tales. The animated segments were based on that, and the character was based on some of Joel Chandler Harris's Uncle Remus Tales, but the rest was a brand new screenplay written by a first-time screenwriter, Dalton Raymond. And so a young boy is taken by his mom and dad to his grandmother's plantation in Atlanta, Georgia. And unknown to the young boy, Johnny, his parents are estranged. And so the father leaves to go back to Atlanta, leaving Johnny to try and adapt to this new environment. He wants to run away. He runs into Uncle Remus, and Uncle Remus tells him a story about Br'er Rabbit, and that goes into animation. And so Johnny decides to stay. He makes friends with Toby, who is a young black boy about his same age, and Ginny, a young, very nice girl, but from the wrong side of the tracks, a very poor family, whereas Johnny's family is a lot better off. And Ginny has two older brothers who are a real pain in the rear. And so in the Uncle Remus stories that Uncle Remus is telling, Br'er Rabbit is sort of a surrogate for Johnny, little Johnny, and getting out of trouble. And Br'er Fox and Br'er Bear are sort of symbolic of Ginny's two older brothers who are constantly teasing Ginny and Johnny and getting them into trouble. Now, the mother, Johnny's mother, fears that these stories that are being told are not good for Johnny. They're, you know, and so forbids Remus from telling him any more stories. So Remus decides to, okay, I'm going to pack up and I'm going to leave, and I'm actually going to go to Atlanta because a boy needs his father. I'm going to let his father know, needs to come back. Johnny hears about this and runs to try and stop Remus, and he cuts through a pen that has a bull, and the bull, of course, Johnny's wearing red as well, too. The bull gores Johnny, so Johnny is hanging there between life and death. The father does show up. It does have a happy ending. I hate for that to be a spoiler for you. It does have a happy ending there, and Remus is told, no, we were wrong to tell you not to tell stories, and all of that. And so that's sort of the Cliff Notes classic illustrated version of Disney's Song of the South. It runs roughly about 90 minutes, and as I said, a third of that is devoted to those animated tales.
And look, I think it's significant not just because it's a great story and there's life lessons and there's great music and there's great animation, but I think this is really, I said it's significant because it seems to be the first live-action film that really deals with some heavy kind of real-life drama, right? We've seen the animated films where a character or an animal loses a parent, but this is one where, you know, a kid is dealing with, you know, divorce and difficult things like that, and it's really addressed in a different kind of way for Disney.
It is, but it's still on that same level of fantasy, which again, an awful lot of audiences didn't grasp. You know, Walt was not trying to make a historical documentary of what life was like in the Old South, you know, after the Civil War. He was making a film that was just as much a fantasy as Cinderella, whatever, and you can see that because Mary Blair was doing a lot of the background designs, and that same color influenced the live action. But yes, as you said, there's very dramatic moments because Walt was looking at this as his first live action film, and he wanted to be competitive with other fully live-action films that were out there. And so the cameraman for this was Greg Tolan, who was the very famous cameraman for Citizen Kane. And this was the very first time he worked in color, you know, to get this done. And Walt, and as you said, everything is not all peaches and cream, even though it's a fantasy-type environment, yeah, there's some very heavy-duty issues. Your parents are breaking up. Being a young kid and trying to be accepted in a new environment, learning that there's different social classes and not understanding how that all works out. And again, this was a highly innovative film for the time because, again, Johnny's best friend is this little black boy. And the little black boy is not his servant, right. Is not subservient to that. The black characters are all sympathetic and clever and warm and friendly. You know, most of the white characters are sometimes dysfunctional or... In the case of the mother, she's really just not listening to her son. You know, I'm expecting it done this way, and she's not being sensitive to what he's going through. And this was unique because when this film was released, it was released November 1946, and 1947 is where it had the wide release. You know, usually you had movie theaters that were only for white patrons and only for African-American patrons. And if you had a film, there were sometimes films that were made just for black theaters, where you'd have black cowboys and black detectives, all of this. Or if you had a typical Hollywood film like a musical, you would have someone like Lena Horne in a separate segment so it could be cut out, so it could be shown in the South. Song of the South is one of the first films that is showing this sort of racial equality that was not censored, you know. And in terms of racism, you had films that were much more racist, including Shirley Temple films like Little Rebel and Little Colonel, where she's dancing with Bill Bojangles Robinson. One of those films actually takes place during the Civil War. And yes, they're all happy to be working on that plantation and happy to be working for Little Miss Shirley Temple there. That's even more of a fantasy than Song of the South. And Gone with the Wind, of course, is even more extreme. But I think, and we talked about this a little earlier while we were sitting around and walking around the resort here, is that Disney is a very prominent target. And so people picked on this.
Well, I think to that point, too, you know, Michael Eisner specifically did not want Uncle Remus in the attraction, but he really is the most endearing character in the film. And when I watched it and when I watch it again, I look at things like, when we talk about the use of race and race in the film, and you talk about how, you know, this racial prejudice doesn't affect Johnny. It just is not something. His best friends are Uncle Remus and Toby, right? And how Uncle Remus even and Miss Dasha, how they get along. They sort of have this common concern for the children, sort of forgetting about any sort of racial inequalities or what had taken place prior, and the two elders kind of coming together, looking after their concerns for the family.
And you know, I had a I was on a panel discussion with two Black History I can't talk today.
See,
I
guess that's not that
it's catching. I guess it's the area here. Two Black history instructors from UCF, University of Central Florida. You know, and they were going on, oh, and look, when Remus is talking to the grandmother, you know, his eyes go down, you know, and that's that slave master mentality. And I said, no, he's just being deferential to her because she's a woman. She's trying to run that plantation by herself, you know. And so you can't start to read in all of these elements that weren't that. You can't look at this film with the eyes of 2013. You've got to look at this through the eyes of 1947, in which case it really was the least offensive of any of the Hollywood films that were coming out. And as we've been talking about back and forth, actually presented a very positive attitude of, yes, a little white boy and a little black boy can play together as peers, you know. And again, Uncle Remus, when I saw it as a kid, you know, it didn't even register to me, oh, well, Uncle Remus is black and maybe he's a slave and all that. I just thought, what a nice guy and what a great storyteller.
You could see why Johnny takes to him because he's so warm and he's so grandfatherly. I mean, look, I even saw it as, at the end of the film, you know, not only does Johnny come out of it, but even Sally kind of gets past her prejudice a little bit to save her son. And that's sort of the other ultimate resolution, is she's gotten past her prejudice towards Uncle Remus.
Well, what is amazing, and there's so many things about the film that people miss, is at the very end of the film, when Johnny runs into Uncle Remus, and Uncle Remus says, "Oh, and where are you going?" He says, "Well, we're following Br'er Rabbit." And then suddenly the animated Br'er Rabbit is there, and Johnny and the rest are following. Take a look at Uncle Remus's face, and he is just blown away. It's almost like, they really are real? What is this? And it's that magic of storytelling, of going on. And yes, you know, the father and the mother get back together and realize that the most important thing, you know, is the child, and they can reconcile these differences. Sally realizes that, you know, she can't raise Johnny in this strict format, that, you know, it's a new world, it's a different world, and her son is so important that, and he's a good kid too, you know, to let him grow up. A lot of positive things, and you go away feeling positive. You mentioned zippity doo-dah. A lot of people don't realize that phrase, that word, does not exist in the Joel Chandler Harris stories. That is a word that was invented by Walt Disney. Hmm. Walt Disney loved those kind of words, like bibbidi bobbidi boo and supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Well, in fact, you know Richard Sherman, and talked with Richard Sherman. Richard Sherman was hesitant to call the song supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, right? Until Walt stepped in and said, "No, I love that. That's what we're going with."
Yeah, and you know, the thing about this film, and part of the reason why we're talking about it, is because we like this film, we like the message, we like the story, it ends the way Disney's films are supposed to, happily ever after, and the sun sets. But from its initial release, there has always been controversy, and controversy that has continued to this day, which is part of the reason why we're talking about it, part of the reason why it's brought up at shareholder meetings, possibly for the last time after this last one. And I think, Jim, and certainly I would never tell somebody who finds something uncomfortable or offensive not to feel that way, but some of the very early controversy came from people who were creating controversy after not even seeing the film. So, for example, the NAACP issues a statement talking about perpetuating this glorified picture of slavery and this idyllic master-slave relationship, distorting facts, although they admit later on that the person who put that statement out never actually saw the film, never realized that it's this Reconstruction era, post-Civil War, post-master-slave relationship time.
And again, some of the fault has got to fall on Walt, that he didn't make this clear. You know, all it would have taken is in the first couple of seconds of the film saying 1867 or whatever, and so you would know, you know, or 1870, whatever. And again, I'm with you. I don't want to be insensitive to those people who are upset by images in this film. But one of the reasons I wrote the book was, and you know me, I don't write sleazy, I don't write tabloid. It's just the facts. It's sort of like you're buying the making of Song of the South book. So you get the background of what choices were made, why the choices were made, why maybe some of those choices were bad. But what happened at that time period is, you have to realize, is that black folks were being lynched in the South. In fact, they were trying to push through an anti-lynching law of all things, and Truman was dragging his feet about supporting such a thing. To me, this is just horrendous. This is just, you know, outrageous. And there were so many films that were out there that, you know, you did have black actors, and the only way you were seeing them were in subservient roles or in comic roles where they were supposed to be flustered or lazy or illiterate or all of these negative things, and there were no other images balancing that out. Today we have plenty of positive images, whether it's Bill Cosby and the Huxtable family, or Barack Obama as president, or whatever. We have tons of other images to compensate for that. But in the 1940s, when this came out, the only images that were coming out of black people were putting them in these negative positions. And so, if you want to attack that, you don't attack a minor B film that nobody's ever going to see. You go for a big target, and Disney was a big target. And as Lou pointed out, yes, when the NAACP released that statement, of course, there's a lot of wrong things. First off, it doesn't take place during the time of slavery. But the statement was based because they were being pushed to come and release a statement. The statement was released early because two secretaries went and saw an early screening of the film. And I've read those letters, and they're mentioned and they're quoted in my book. And they loved the film. They thought the film was great. They thought the film was funny. But again, they said, you know, we need to point out that some of those stereotypical images are still there. The black sharecroppers, you know, singing the spirituals. There's a heavy use of dialect. Well, the point of this is that dialect was natural at that time period, and it wasn't just for African Americans. It was white people used some of that dialect as well. I have friends in the South, and they come up and they say, get me a pop. And I say, what, a soda? You want a soda? Yeah, a pop. Well, what kind of a pop? Well, a Coke pop. What? What are you talking about? So there's some of that. And you need to realize that the voices and the performers of the sharecroppers, and they're not slaves, they're sharecroppers, is the Hall Johnson Choir. The Hall Johnson Choir was a very famous African-American choir. Hall Johnson himself was very adamant about black rights and all, but he put together a choir because he felt it was necessary to preserve the spirituals and all of these songs, because they hadn't been written down. They'd only been passed along orally. And so Green Grow the Lilacs and all of that, his group provided the music. They're the voices of the Crows in Dumbo, by the way, except for Jim Crow, who is Cliff Edwards, Jiminy Cricket. So they're doing this, and he would never have... Paul Johnson would never have partnered with any project that he thought was demeaning to that. And again, if you listen to these spirituals, slaves never sang because they were happy. Slaves sang to try and lift their spirits. And so in the film, they're singing on their way to work, and they're singing on their way back to work, you know, to try and do that. And then the third time that they sing, it's because they're concerned that the Johnny is up there and Johnny may die. And I think all of that is legitimate and not promoting, oh, well, you know, all these happy folk. That's not the intent in the film. That's not the purpose in the film. That's not the way it's used. But again, you take a look at how it's used in other films, and so you go, oh, yeah, well, oh, yes. And even today, there are people who condemn the film who have not seen it. A very famous African-American film director, Spike Lee, I was told this, condemns the film, doesn't want it to be released, has never seen it. And by the way, for those of you who are, oh, well, I don't know if I should buy Jim's book because I don't know if that's an iffy type thing. That's one of the reasons the foreword is written by Disney legend Floyd Norman. Floyd Norman was Disney's first black animator and story man. He was hired by Walt himself. He knew Walt. He said, I don't know about all of these people who are calling Walt racist. He says, I worked with Walt. When I was a story man, I was pulled up into the story meetings, and there was Walt, and I could see him in action. And he never treated me any better than anybody else or any worse than anybody else. He says he treated us all the same. He treated us all like we were jerks. He said, and we didn't know anything. And come on, let's get on the ball and get this done. Floyd loves the film. And in the foreword, he writes a nice lengthy foreword. At one point, Floyd was working for Disney Publications. And over the Christmas season, which we're in now, Disney used to release a Christmas comic strip that would start appearing in November, and it would appear daily in a newspaper, and then it would end up on December 25th, and Santa Claus would have come and helped the Dalmatians save the day or whatever. And so Floyd decided that since he loved the film so much, he was going to write a comic strip about Johnny and Ginny going to Uncle Remus and asking about, you know, it's so warm we might not get snow. There was even global warming in those days. We might not get snow. Will Santa Claus ever find us? And so Uncle Remus starts to tell a story about how Br'er Rabbit felt the same way and how it did get resolved and how Santa showed up and all of that. And he said, sent it in, it got penciled, the whole bit. Editors of newspapers sent these, terrible, terrible letters about how dare Disney do this and how insensitive Disney is. And Floyd says, I would have liked to have seen the look on their faces when they pointed out that the guy who wrote this was black. And he says, but it did run, and there were no complaints in any of the newspapers whatsoever. So sometimes people are reacting ahead of time, right, rather than from what is actually there. I do feel there's a strong need to be able to put the film in context, right, especially for younger audiences, because Lou and I were talking a little earlier today about we've got an entire generation who really doesn't know Walt Disney. It really doesn't remember things like rotary phones or things like that, or a time where, no, the TV was black and white and you only got three channels. You know, so a lot of this stuff, a lot of history has been forgotten. Anything beyond 10 years, a lot of young people don't know. So it needs to be put into context, and I think is a wonderful springboard for conversations between parents and children and between other people.
I agree. And, you know, Roger Ebert, who is the noted film critic, who has always been a proponent of everything should be out there for people to see and mm-hmm. judge. This is actually one of the few films, he says, that he thinks that because it's a Disney film, because it becomes the consciousness of mm-hmm. American children, should not. Students should see it, but kids should not, because they take films more literally than do adults. And to that point, Jim, I agree with that, but I've shown this film to my kids. I have it in digital format. My kids have watched it multiple times. And when they see it, they don't see it in terms of race. They see, you know, Johnny and his friend without there being a distinction of color. That's how my kids are being raised. So they're not looking at it in terms of, well, Dad, where did this really fit into the whole context of slavery? It's these two people are getting along, different colors, different backgrounds, everything else like that. So I agree that it should be shown as long as that's the message that you are explaining to those who might need help sort of interpreting that.
And actually, to enlarge in that, it has been shown frequently in the last few years without that context, and no race riots have been generated. It hasn't been shown theatrically in the United States since 1986, but it's been released in Japan, it's been released in Europe, and it's been released in South America. The BBC, the UK, has played it several times during the Christmas season. And again, there's no comments, there's no negative feedback, and this is without historical context. I know that, and again, I don't blame the Disney Company. I didn't write this book to annoy or embarrass the Disney Company. I wrote this book so that the information about the film could get out there, so that when people do have conversations about the film, they have a better understanding about what they're seeing and why it's there, and who worked on that, and how that led to led to other things. But I don't blame the Disney Company for not releasing it, because the Disney company is a very prominent target, and there will be people who will react to it, never seeing the film, but just, oh my gosh, this right. is demeaning,
and the knee-jerk reaction,
and all of that. And so, you know, I was disappointed that Bob Iger even took off the table a limited release. I hope that, just like the Disney Treasures, you know, if there was a limited release and it was obviously marketed just to adults, you know, would that work? But the last time Iger was asked, he even pulled that off the table, because again, there's nothing to be gained from the right. Disney Company releasing this. The Disney Company still makes a ton of merchandise money from these characters. not Uncle Remus, but Brer Rabbit and Brer Bear and Brer Fox, and also off of Splash Mountain. But I will say that it breaks my heart a little bit to, because I know this personally, that there are people who ride that attraction and have no idea that it's connected to a Disney film whatsoever, or why that film was made. Or, and again, most of the animators who worked on this said that this is some of the favorite animation they have ever done. And this Roy E. Disney, I was talking with him, and he was trying to promote, well, can we just package and release the animation? Mm. And now you're getting into the dialect and all that. And again, the people who did the voices were, again, black performers. James Basquiat not only did Uncle Remus, he did the fox. He did Brer Fox. And in fact, everyone I talked to, Frank Thomas, Ollie Johnson, said, my gosh, he was one of our favorite voice artists ever, because he could talk so fast, but he could go up high, he could go low, he could put so much into this, and he could get out 2 words a second, which is faster than we could animate it. Brer Rabbit was done by Johnny Lee, who is a black singer. And in fact, an interesting thing is during the Laughing Place scene, Johnny Lee wasn't available to record Brer Rabbit's voice because he was overseas on a USO tour. James Basquiat stepped in and did Brer Rabbit's voice in there. And the laugh that he does is reused in Jungle Book when Baloo tickles King Louie. This is all in the book, folks. This is all in the book. And I'm not giving away the book. There's more in the book than all of this. And, of course, Brer Bear was done by Nick Stewart. And I got a chance to meet him out in California when he was like, gosh, in his late 70s, almost 80, because they had brought him out of retirement to do the voice of Brer Bear in the Splash Mountain attraction. And so I was talking to him and I said, well, you know, did you feel uncomfortable doing this film? Were you? He said, no. He says, we were treated like kings. And he says, and I love the character, and this is part of our heritage and part of our background. And he says, and you know what I did with the money, right? And I said, no. What he did with the money from working on Amos and Andy and also working on Song of the South, he took that money and he created a very prestigious all-black theater company in Los Angeles, because that was his dream, was to create a theater company where blacks could perform as more than just butlers and maids and all of that. So all of the money he made from this went right into that theater. Very, very nice man, funny man, and no resentment even in retrospect. He says, I wish they'd release that film more. He says, I love that film.
Well, my disappointment in the lack of the release of the film is because people are not able to enjoy and appreciate, you can even break it down, the individual elements, right? Whether it's the music, the animation, the actor's performance, which obviously was worthy of an Oscar at a time when he normally would not have gotten it. And look, to me, the message of this is, I think, the message that is meant to be portrayed at the end, which is people of different race and colors and backgrounds getting along together, working together, having a common love and interest in family. I think that's what the message is that, you know, I know that my kids took away from it. So that's where my disappointment comes in terms of that.
Well, I think the real message is that people of any age, any sex, any race can get along with animated characters. I think that is the theme of the film there. Do not be afraid of animated characters, no matter what you saw in Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Well, I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way. So my question for those people who are listening is this. Actually, I have two questions. Is one, have you seen Song of the South? But number two, do you think it should be released again? Should this be put out for home release, limited release, theatrical release, whatever it may be?
Should there be any restrictions? And the other question,
or should it be put in context? Do you put a title card in the front saying this film takes place in such and such year, it's in the Reconstruction era?
You know, or even have a prominent black performer or spokesman, you know, do one of those little short introductions, you know, a couple of minutes before that. And then the other question that needs to be asked is, have you bought my book, Who's Afraid
exactly,
of the Song of the
that
South?
Was question
and why not? And,
well, because it just came out. So, I mean, yeah. The song that literally just came out.
Yeah.
And the thing that's great, look, Jim, you go not through just the history, and again, this is the way you do it is not you taking sources that you, online. It's you literally going and speaking to people who worked on the film. Right? Yeah. So you talk about the troubles with making the film, the problems with the screenplay, the actors, the animation, Walt Disney's personal contributions, and lots more. And then also you put the film in context today, and a lot about what we were speaking about too. But there's a bonus because the book is called "Who's Afraid of the Song of the South." But there's more additional stories about there from things that maybe from other stories that maybe you hadn't heard before about, you know, some
Walt becoming a Republican. Why did Walt become a Republican since he was apolitical? Well, I will tell you this. When I announced to people that I was going to be doing a book on Song of the South, just the topic alone was controversial, even though I tried to say, look, you know me. I'm not going to be, you know, a TMZ reporter or a National Enquirer reporter, whatever. I just want the facts out there of the people doing that. Oh no. So what I did to fill out the book was I have a lot of other stories where just the topic alone is going to be controversial. So for instance, I talk about a character called Sunflower. Excuse me, a character called Sunflower, who was the little black centaurette in Fantasia, who was edited out. And so I talk about how that character developed and what scene she was in and who animated those scenes. But at the end of that chapter, I point out that cutting Sunflower out of the film was made in 1956 by Walt Disney himself. All of those who claim that he's racist, he's the one who said, well, I think this may be insensitive. We're going to eliminate this. We talk about why Walt became a Republican, a conservative Republican later in life, where in the early part of his life, he was apolitical. But on his deathbed, he turns to his daughter Diane and says, I always considered myself a true liberal for this. We talk about...
There's UFOs. Any book that has UFOs in it, you know...
We talk about Ward Kimball because we talk about the trilogy of the three space shows for the Disneyland TV show. There was actually supposed to be a fourth show about UFOs, and Walt supported this, and how it almost got made until the U.S. military stepped in and just put a stop to this. We have stories about the making of John Carter, all of the original versions before the one that came out that Disney was going to do, Walt's attempt to make a Wizard of Oz movie. We even have a chapter about Jessica Rabbit and how the character was created, how the character developed, how the character changed, and then how Disney just had their hands full with this character and tried to eliminate her cleavage and the slit up her dress and all of this because they had never had to deal with such a blatantly sexy character before. So there's 17 of those stories. And again, if you're still hesitant, out right now is the revised Vault of Walt. The Vault of Walt, I shifted publishers, so I had to pull the book out of release for about 6 weeks, and suddenly on Amazon they were selling copies for $3,000.
So I got emails from people who said, Jim's book is on Amazon for $300. Is it really that good? I said, do not buy this book
yet.
Because we knew that this book was coming out.
And so not only is the book out now, and it's out less expensive, but I've added, for all of those people who've been such strong supporters, I added 5 additional stories in there, including Walt's favorite recipes and how Walt would eat. And also a chapter called The Man Who Shot Walt Disney, which actually refers to a photographer, Rene Bardot, who shot the famous photo of Walt walking through the castle, and also the last photo of Walt, you know, waving with Mickey. So Remember that I'm an orphan. Remember that it's the holiday season. Lou, thank you so much for letting me share some of these stories and clear up some misconceptions. And by the way, in the book, there's all sorts of little fun facts that nobody has ever brought out about Who's Afraid of the Song of the South. For instance, we all know Clarence Nash, the voice of Donald Duck, right? He was also an expert at doing bird calls. He does the bird chirps for Mr. Bluebird on Uncle Remus's shoulder. And Lou's going, all right, okay.
I almost did my worst Mr. Bluebird impression, but I won't. My Walt Disney impression was bad enough.
Bobby Driscoll, who played Johnny, didn't know how to skip. So they had Disney animators like Ham Lusk out there skipping around, showing him this is how skipping looks. So for the last scene, do that. But there's a lot of background, and again, it's broken up into nice little sizable chunks. So there's a chapter on how the project began. There's a chapter on the screenplay. There's a chapter on the live action actors. There's a chapter on the animation. There's even a chapter on the controversy at the time and why the controversy has continued to this day. And again, I think we can find a balance. I don't blame people who are a little sensitive to the film being re-released, but I think we can find a balance there where all of us can enjoy this and enjoy something of Walt's at his peak, and characters that I think can still today help teach us lessons, just like Aesop's Fables.
I agree, and I want to make it easy for everybody. I'm going to put links to Who's Afraid of the Song of the South and the revised Vault of Walt in this week's show notes, both the Kindle version and the print version. You should really get both. One to read on your device, one to put on your shelf to save, because we like seeing books and collecting books on our shelves.
Do you want any fun facts about new Port Orleans?
We got to come back and do Port Orleans again.
Port Orleans?
Which is going to give us an excuse to go have beignets over at Riverside.
That's right. They should have beignets at both places.
I agree with you. So, yeah, visit the show notes over at wdwradio.com/305. You can comment on the show. You can comment on Song of the South, answer our questions. And if you have any questions for Jim, you can post them there, too. Jim will check the comments as well. Jim Corcus, Vault of Walt, Who's Afraid of Song of the South? You are a good man, Charlie Brown. Always love having you on. And congratulations on your two new books. And thank you again so much for sharing your stories with us.
And thank you, Lou, and happy holidays not only to you but to your listeners. They're the most wonderful listeners in the world. I told Lou before we started taping today, a lot of people are described as Disney historians. I consider Lou a Disney historian, but I think Lou is the only Disney historian that can be described as the beloved Disney historian. He is so loved by all of you, and I see that when I go to events as well. And I am here to tell you that what you hear on these podcasts is exactly how he is in real life. He is a wonderful friend. He has been inspirational and supportive of me. And so his name is in the back in the acknowledgments of both of my books. So when you get the books, make sure you take them to a Lou meet and greet and have Lou give you an autograph there. Thank you again, Lou. Happy holidays.
Jim, thanks to you as well, too. I'm not the... I'm really more of the huggable Disney historian. That's a, and I'm much taller in person.
Are you the Duffy Disney historian? Okay.
It's time for the Walt Disney World Trivia Question of the Week, where I challenge you to test your knowledge of Walt Disney World history, see how well you pay attention to the details in what you see, hear, and experience in the parks. We'll then randomly select one winner for a Disney prize package,
But before we get to this week's question, let's go back, review last week's, and select our winner. So on last week's show, we had the full recap and review of New Fantasyland, Test Track, and Splitsville. And I told you how much I loved the details and the stories and the connection to Dumbo in Storybook Circus. So the question was to see how well you knew the film and its connection to Storybook Circus's story. So I quoted at the beginning a line from the film where we talk about how the storks fly through the snow and the sleet and the hail, through the blizzards and over the mountains and over the plains, so they could deliver the circus animals. And your question was simply this: in what U.S. state did the storks deliver Dumbo and the other circus animals to? And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense that Storybook Circus is right here in Florida, because that's the answer to the question. And here's a couple of quick did you knows about the film Dumbo. Did you know that it was the only Disney animated feature film that has a title character that doesn't speak? Right? Dumbo never talks. And in fact, Mrs. Jumbo, who's Dumbo's mom, only speaks once when she says Dumbo's name. And speaking of the film being set in Florida, did you also know that this was the first Walt Disney animated feature film, and still one of very few, that was actually set in the United States? So congratulations and thank you to the hundreds of you once again that entered and got this one correctly. You're playing for all of my audio tours of the Magic Kingdom, a WDW Radio luggage tag, button, and a set of mystery Disney pins from New Fantasyland. This week's winner is Sarah Zarenko. So Sarah, congratulations. Please send me your address. I'll get your package out to you right away. If you played last week and didn't win, thank you again for playing. And don't worry, because here's your next chance to enter in this week's Walt Disney World Trivia Challenge. As I mentioned during the recording of this week's show, Jim and I taped it at one of my favorite, moderate, really favorite of all the Walt Disney World resorts, Port Orleans French Quarter. I love the theming, it's quaint, it's charming, it's small, you can get po'boys in the food court, and there's so much story here. It's modeled after the styles and architecture of the French Quarter in New Orleans, sort of the deep south of America by the lower Mississippi River. And even the check-in lobby is themed. So here's your question this week. What type of building is the registration lobby of Port Orleans French Quarter Resort themed after? You can email your answer to contest@wdwradio.com. You have until 11:59 p.m. on Sunday, December 23rd. And again, you're playing for all the audio tours, a luggage tag, a button, and a special holiday Mickey Mouse Santa Vinylmation. So good luck and have fun. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thanks again for taking the time and tuning in this and every week. Thanks also to my guest and friend, Jim Korkus. I'm going to have links where you can purchase Jim's books on Kindle and in print in this week's show notes over at wdwradio.com/305. You can also comment there as well. Again, Jim and I will comment back and forth with you. Keep the conversation going from this week's show. While you're on the site, don't forget to check out our daily blog posts from so many great guest authors. We have contests, photos, our fun, free, family-friendly discussion forums, new videos each week, and more. Also, be sure and sign up for our newsletter. It's a free monthly email newsletter that has exclusive content, contests, offers, deals, information, updates, and opportunities. You can visit wdwradio.com/news or click the link at the top of the page. And I'd love to hear back from you as well. So if you have a question or a comment, you can email me at lou@wdwradio.com. You can also call the voicemail. Be heard on the air, 407-900-9391. That's 407-900-WDW1. With a question, a comment, you could just say hello from the parks. But as much as I love connecting with you guys on things like Twitter, I'm at Lou Mangiello, and the Facebook page, you can come like us over at facebook.com/WDW Radio. I believe that nothing beats a handshake and a hug. We've got lots of events coming up this month and in 2013. Our next meet of the month in Walt Disney World is Saturday, December 22nd at 1 o'clock at the Tomorrowland Terrace in the Magic Kingdom. Sort of come celebrate the holidays with us before the end of the year. Anyone and everyone is invited. Our next meet of the month is going to be January during our annual January meet of the month during Marathon Weekend. That's going to be Saturday, January 12th from 2 to 4 p.m. And we're going to meet in a new location, someplace we've never had a meet of the month before, and that's going to be in Storybook Circus. We're going to be in the seating area up by Pete's Silly Sideshow. There's places to sit. There's food there as well. And because it's at 2 o'clock, it gives you time to shower, ice up, relax after the half marathon that morning. Good time to get together, meet, and make some new friends as well. Also, there's more events coming up in 2013, including our On the Road event. That's going to be also in January. Friday, January 4th, I'm going to be out in Las Vegas speaking at the New Media Expo. We're going to have a get-together for a meal or a snack over at the Cypress Street Marketplace Food Court at Caesar's Palace. You can find information about that. All the meets of the month are upcoming events in 2013, including Aulani, our cruise on the Disney Fantasy in November, events over at the Walt Disney Family Museum, other meets of the month in Walt Disney World, and lots more. All of it is at the events page over at wdwradio.com, or if you like our page over on Facebook, you can RSVP on each of the individual event pages there as well. Quick thanks to my partners and sponsors, Mouse Fan Travel. They'll help you get wherever you're going. If you're coming out to Walt Disney World or Disneyland, Adventures by Disney, Aulani, the Disney Cruise, they're my official, they're my recommended travel provider. It's who I've used for years, not just because of the discounts, but really because of the service that they give you, all at no additional cost to you. They're over at mousefantravel.com. When you're coming down to Walt Disney World, maybe you want something a little larger. Maybe you want an up to an 8-bedroom home for the entire family. Bring all your friends down for their own master bedrooms, game rooms, kitchen, pools, and spas. You can check them out over at allstarvacationhomes.com. And if you want some Disney magic delivered right to you, whether it's in print, at your home, or on your iPad, you can also get Celebrations Magazine by visiting celebrationspress.com. You can also visit the show notes this week for a direct link to the iPad version as well. As always, my friends, and you are my friends, whether we have met yet or not, all I ask is that if you like the show, please help spread the word. Let others know about it. Tweet out that you're listening. Share links on Facebook, Pinterest, Google+, your favorite Disney discussion forums. And please come by, rate and review the show and the app over in iTunes as well. And finally, you know, in the wake of so many tragic, sad times recently, close to home and others elsewhere around the world, I hope that you can turn to our shared love of Disney for a small, bright spot of hope and happiness, which is why I like talking about the things that simply make us happy about a place and this belief that we have in simple family fun that I think we all share. So my sincere thanks to you for letting me have a bright spot by being able to share my passion for Disney with you in this and so many different ways. And I hope that you start turning your own dreams into action, because action leads to results, and results will lead to you living the life that you dream about. Get out there, be amazing, love others, be kind, have fun, and until next week, see ya.
Hey Lou, this is Nicholas from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, otherwise known as Mickey Mouse 100 in the Box, and I just got back from Disney World. I went for 10 days, the 27th of November to the 7th of December, and I was there for the 6th of December opening of the new Fantasyland and Test Track. And I went on the Little Mermaid ride, and I think that that's more for smaller kids, but I think that anybody that likes the Little Mermaid ride of all ages could go on it at least once. And the new Test Track, well, I really love the futuristic feeling of it all. And I just want to wish you good luck on everything that you're going to do in the future, and you've done an amazing job in everything that you've done so far. And I've been getting your Celebration magazines since 2009, like for 3 years. They're really good, too. And the audio guides I love also. Thank you for taking this voicemail. Goodbye. You've got a friend.
Yeah.
Hey, Vern. The car's all gassed up, so let's load up the shuttle and head for the puddle. The Splash Mountain liftoff is A-OK, all systems go, and T-minus. And Vern, since I'm a highly trained Top Gun splashtonaut, I'll do the driving. So why don't you run in the house and get on some of them long pants and some of that musk oil, and you and I will go to Disneyland and find us some action.